Welcome to Chasing Sound. This is Kirk. Get your mic on over there?
I think I'm on, yeah.
Say hello to the people.
Bob Daly here.
We are here at KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live at koop.org. This is Chasing Sound, bringing you down from that smooth, smooth jazz. When's the last time you listened to Kenny G's Christmas album? Think about that. Smooth, smooth jazz. Happy birthday, Jesus. It's smooth jazz. So tonight we're going to get into soundtracks. It's going to be all over the place. At some point I realized it had a heavy emphasis on some films from the 90s, but I mostly just went through what I had, and I avoided a few things, namely heavy classical stuff. I noticed in my collection at home that I had the soundtrack for the first Conan film with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which was all heavy orchestral stuff. And I thought about the mornings when I'm listening to, the radio, and then a DJ, what's his name, John Ely?
Right, Ely.
Yeah. There's some mornings where I'm like, man, this guy has the best taste in music. I'm having so much fun. And then other mornings I'm like, man, he's boring me to tears. And I think it's because he tries to throw in opera and classical music. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I specifically left that off tonight because I didn't want to just show off my music library. Like, right. I wanted to have some things that would hold people's interest. Soundtrack music is mostly to be enjoyed with film. It's got an interesting history though. So before there was dialogue in cinema, they used live music. So the silent film era ran roughly from 1894 to 1929. There was nothing recorded and synchronized. That's what made the first talkies, when they synced up sound with the film. But instead, they had dialogue that appeared on short little cards in between shots to kind of let you know where the story was going. And then you had brilliant actors like Louis Brooks and Charlie Chaplin, who used body language and just epic creation to sort of bring the story to life and make you feel like you were hearing the dialogue. So to fill up the absence of sounds, they used either live orchestras, and that would be for more of a major release film in a big, nice theater, or just typically what they had was an in-house pianist playing a relatively in-tune piano alongside the film to give you a pacing. You just think back to any time you've seen a silent film on, you know, AMC or whatever, you're just watching TV and you see a silent film or maybe a documentary about them, and you think of the film rolling out in this bouncy saloon sounding piano, kind of telling you how to feel, where your emotions are supposed to go. And, very little has changed. The music still kind of caters to your emotions. So the music played two parts. One, it would sort of add an extra dimension. You wouldn't just have this 2D experience with the visual. You would have music working on your emotions, which would open up the scope of your imagination and get you a little bit more locked into what you were seeing. And this was especially noticeable with a live orchestra. If you've ever seen, sometimes in Austin they'll have, like at the North Door or at the Paramount Theater, they'll show a silent film, a classic one, and a live band will do the score for it. I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure, but
usually an organ, you know.
Yeah, an organ is another classic thing that take me out to the ball game sounding organ.
Right.
But I've seen a few where different bands, local bands, have made. You know, I saw a Russian documentary that was a silent film, and there was a live band, and this group had composed. I think Justin Sherborne was the guy. He had composed a new score to go with the film, and it was really lush hearing it all together. So the music played a double role in the silent film era. It helped you emotionally, also helped the entertainment value, but it also covered up the sound of primitive projectors, which, from what I understand, were incredibly loud, like something akin to your neighbor mowing his lawn at 3 a.m. while drunk, just disturbingly loud and out of place because you're in a dark room trying to watch something. So the music also gave the depth, but it wasn't until talkies came around that directors really got to sink their hooks into it. Suddenly, once there were talkies, the director or whoever was guiding the creative vision could also pick the music, go out and pick standards, hits of the day, get, you know, buy the sheet music rights or whatever they needed, and sort of link it up to their film and make it that much more powerful. You know, think Gone with the Wind, Sound of Music. What would any of these films be without their soundtrack? And this continued on, and directors got more and more bold. They eventually stopped just buying the rights to songs and started employing their own musicians and composers to try and get a sound that elevated the movie in a unique way. And it's hard to describe, but once the visual creator has a partner on the music side of things, you know, things can really come to life. Think of like Star Wars, how much the soundtrack did for that first Star Wars film and what it's done for so many films over time. It becomes a big part of your memory of a film. So we're going to start off tonight with a track from Wendy Carlos. Now, Wendy Carlos used to be Walter Carlos, and at that time he was instrumental in helping an inventor named Bob Moog sort of create and finish up his amazing synthesizer, which the original Moog synth machine was the size of a, you know, maybe a grand piano up on its butt, or another way to think of it is it cost about as much as a house cost. So it was not like a practical thing. Only the wealthy, you know, people like Stevie Wonder were able to get their hands on stuff like this for the studio. But you had to already have some level of success to get your hands on it. But in order to legitimize this machine, Bob Moog employed the services of a composer and then also Walter Carlos, who was a classically trained composer, musician. And so Walter Carlos at the time adapted Bach tunes. It was called Switched on Bach, played all through the new Moog synthesizer machine. And it ended up becoming the biggest selling classical album of all time. I don't know if it still holds that title, but at the time it was one of the few classical albums to ever chart. And it was a big deal. A lot of hardcore enthusiasts of classical music said, you shouldn't be doing that. You know, you shouldn't be disrespecting Bach. It's just a weird thing. People are always afraid of technology. Musicians' unions tried to sue over the creations of some of these keyboards, saying that they would take jobs away from real musicians. So it's an interesting and sordid thing. So at some point, Stanley Kubrick, the great film director, arguably the greatest of all time, he sort of fell in love with the style of Switched on Bach, and he got the services of, at that time, Walter Carlos and now Wendy Carlos to make the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, which is just beautiful. It's basically classical pieces done through the Moog, and then you match that up with other kind of hokey numbers like Singing in the Rain. It's unforgettable. When you hear the music from Clockwork Orange, your mind goes straight to that very, very dark place. So the soundtrack originally had all recordings done in electronic format. Kubrick, being the guy he is, later went in and withdrew about half of them and put in the real classical, like, orchestral versions because he wanted a mix of the two. I think there was a reissue later where you had all of the original Carlos pieces with the electronic format, but the proper soundtrack that's been out for decades and decades has about a mix of half and half of Carlos synthesizers versions and then actual orchestral versions. And of course, Singing in the Rain. We all love that track. So that's the one we're going to start off with tonight. And this is sort of the title music from A Clockwork Orange, one of the darkest films of all time. I'm sure everyone has seen it. And that's how we're going to get started. As soon as I remember how to turn this on.
Thank you.
I know what you're thinking. That sounded weird. Yeah. I love how contemporary that track sounds. Have you ever seen that film, Last Temptation of Christ, or read the book?
I did see it. It's been a long time, though. Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites. It's basically a film that explores the duality of Jesus Christ as like an idea or a person or a movement.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. You just sort of have this moment of hallucinatory action where Christ is on the cross, and for a minute he is sort of in his pain and imagination, imagines a life of not being the Messiah, crawling down off the cross, getting married, having a family, and then he sort of comes to and realizes it's just the devil imposing some fantasy upon him, and he goes back and finishes up what he started on the cross and says, it is accomplished. It's bizarre. Scorsese wanted to make it in the 70s, which at the time, multiple studios were willing to give him huge amounts of money to make it, but he never got around to it. And when he finally did want to make it, it was the late 80s. Hmm. Reaganism, Christian right, all of these things. And suddenly, he couldn't get a studio to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
He could barely scrape together two nickels to make this thing.
Right.
So he made it almost like a college film or a student film. It was like they got a skeletal crew together. He scraped up what investor money he could get, got the rights to the book, got some killer actors who were willing to work for scale just to be in a Scorsese epic. And he went and made this thing for probably a tenth of what he could have made it for in 1979, like as far as investor money. But it made this incredible film. Mm-hmm. Just so, if you're not religious and you haven't followed Christianity, it's a wonderful look into it. I know my older brother was studying to be a youth pastor. He was very keen on Jesus and religion when he was younger. And he and I both loved the film. It was blasted.
Yep.
It was boycotted in nearly every major market. There were protests outside. I remember going to church as a teenager, a youngster, like maybe 12 or 13, and the pastor at my parents' church that they brought me to was talking about the film at length.
Mm-hmm.
None of them had ever seen it or read the book, but they were blasting it as if it was the work of the Antichrist. And they didn't. It's funny, when I finally saw the film a few years later, when I was maybe like 15, I realized, boy, they didn't get the context at all.
I know, it was pretty innocent when you think about it.
Yeah, truly. And the film had so many different variables. They say when the last scene was being filmed, or they wrapped up the shot, the whole "it is accomplished" on the cross thing, one of the assistant directors, and keep in mind they were on a shoestring budget, so they probably weren't getting the top guys, but one of them accidentally opened the film can after it had been filmed, and he realized what he had done and shut it immediately. But if you go back and watch that film at the end, when Willem Dafoe's back on the cross and saying "it is accomplished," the celluloid starts eating itself. And Scorsese, the kid told him about it, and he's like, oh my God, Jesus Christ, or whatever. But he got into the editing bay with his editor and was like, this is amazing. Like, the visually, you couldn't
pay for that.
Oh yeah, you could spend 2 months editing pre-CGI and try to get something even close to that, and you wouldn't. Nothing matches the visual of celluloid eating itself alive. And then it just happened in that perfect moment where he's hanging on the cross and he resigns himself to his fate and realigns himself with the reality of the situation. And then the visual just starts caving in on itself like some beautiful...
Where do you learn these things?
I don't know. It's crazy. I was just telling my friend the other day, like, I can't remember my mom's birthday, but the stuff, like, I can name every Def Leppard album in chronological order. It's weird how my brain works. I would almost trade it for a normal brain, but this is what I got to work with.
All right, what do we got coming up here?
So just to go over that a little bit, though. So the soundtrack for that was made by Peter Gabriel. Scorsese reached out to Peter Gabriel and put him to the challenge. And Peter Gabriel, of course, at that time was one of the biggest acts on the face of the planet. He was huge for his solo work he did after Genesis. And he had never done an instrumental album. You know, Peter Gabriel's known for his incredible vocals. So he gets this group of Eastern musicians together to compose this thing, to give it a very specific sound that would sort of put you into the heat of the desert of the ancient world and what people might have felt like. And he combined that with modern machines, you know, what was available in the late 80s, these digital synthesizers, and sort of wove it together. The whole album is spectacular. It originally was the score for the film, but Peter Gabriel liked it so much, he sort of added a couple of tracks, remixed it, and released it as a proper album release. I don't know how well it did. I don't know if it charted, but it's been a favorite. A lot of people, like, if they have to do homework or an assignment, they'll put it on because it's instrumental and you could sort of get lost in what you're reading or what you're writing with this epic and powerful music. It sounds so contemporary too. Like I play tracks whenever I'm making a mix CD for a friend, I'll put tracks off of that album and they're always asking about it. It's always such an eyebrow raiser. So the next one we're going to get into is from a 90s film, which was another small budget film called Pieces of April. Did you ever see that one?
No, I didn't.
It is really good. It's very simple. It's not a complicated story. It's about, you know, a mother and her daughter. The daughter has moved to New York and got a boyfriend, and the mother always resented her oldest daughter. These references to, like, the first pancake, how you always have to throw away the first pancake because it's always crooked. And so the mother ends up getting breast cancer and has surgery, and the whole thing is just a one day, you know, kind of like Ulysses or whatever that book was, where the whole thing happens in one 24-hour session, where the family is supposed to go to her apartment in New York for Thanksgiving dinner and all kinds of things go wrong. But the end of it is just, it will make anyone cry. It's this beautiful scene where the mother is in a bathroom at a public restaurant and she sees another mother scolding her 11-year-old daughter and being really unkind to her. And the mother with the grown-up daughter, you know, the main character in the movie, looks at this happen, and there's no dialogue. The last 10 minutes of the film have no dialogue. It's all facial reading. And you see the look in her eyes when she looks at that mother being cruel to that little kid having trouble putting her stockings back on after going to the bathroom or something. And she just knows how badly she's messed up, how the past, whatever, 25 years of her life, she's been hurting this child of hers who's now an adult and trying to navigate the world. It's just heartbreaking. And the soundtrack was done by Mr. Malcolmus of the Magnetic Field. So it's got that wonderful, bubbly computer music sound. And it's the film is a beautiful, uplifting heartbreaker full of catharsis. And the soundtrack is, I mean, you can't go wrong with the Magnetic Fields, one of the most interesting bands to come out of the 90s. So this is one called One April Day. I believe I'm already on this one. Yep. Yeah. So let's give it a whirl, everybody.
Thank you. you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com.
Support comes from Clown Dog Bikes, a full-service bicycle shop which treats people and their bikes with respect and kindness. Locally owned, operated, and keeping tires inflated since the year 2000. Located at 2821 San Jacinto. More information at clowndogbikes.com.
Okay. Thanks for those inserts. I recognize those voices.
Yeah.
I think one of those was Kanye, right?
I think so. Yeah, and the next one was Magic Johnson.
And then, yeah, I bet you'll be coming up before too long.
Well, I've got a couple in there somewhere. Yeah,
you do plenty of those things. I hear your voice almost every time I'm here. So again, K-O-O-P, HD1, HD3, Hornsby. You are listening to us stream live at koop.org. This is Kirk, my main man Bob, and we're doing a show about soundtracks tonight. So just before the break, we heard, of course, The Magnetic Fields with One April Day. I love that song because there's one verse, no chorus, no bridge, just one set of lyrics, like a paragraph worth, in the middle of an instrumental which features the electric ukulele. Really beautiful. He's got that great voice too, right? That right. Olive oil voice. And it's just this beautiful line. It's, you know, probably less than a paragraph of lyrics of one April day, we'll go miles away, and then I'll turn to you and say, I've always loved you in my way. I'll always love you in my way, which is sort of sums up the relationship between the mother and the daughter in the film Pieces of April. And I'm telling you, when that song kicks in and when the credits roll for that film, not a dry eye in the house. You're probably a sociopath if you don't cry at that film. So after that, we heard from the Rushmore soundtrack. We're sort of getting into the 90s era of our set list tonight. Of course, Rushmore, a breakout film for a brilliant director. But the part that a lot of people liked was his use of music. He's, for the Rushmore film, he wanted to use 60s bands who at one time or another dressed in that sort of schoolboy outfit. And this was before, you know, the whole Summer of Love really kicked into full swing. A lot of the British bands were wearing suits or sort of Ivy League garb, like the way Buddy Holly and the Crickets had worn, or just generally kind of looking like schoolboys. You know, there were the mods and the rockers. And since Rushmore is set at this academy where you know, it's a private school where you send kids to probably, what was it, maybe first grade through senior year of high school. And it's one of those fancy schools that most of us never went to, but the music goes along with it in that it's these British bands that dressed a certain way. It's a killer soundtrack. There really isn't a bad song on it. Who was his name? Wes Anderson, is that the guy's name? Did all those movies, but that was, you know, he did Bottle Rocket before Rushmore, but Rushmore was his first big breakout where it seemed like everyone was just suddenly addicted to his style, his constant use of Bill Murray, which of course Bill Murray puts a smile on everyone's face. So that was the band Creation. Interesting thing to note is that Creation didn't last very long. I think maybe had a couple of records and a handful of singles, but in the 60s, they were Pete Townshend, the guitar player from The Who. Pete Townshend cited them as his favorite band, and he was sure they were going to be the next huge thing, but you know how things happen. Things don't pan out the way they're supposed to. So what do we got next here? Next, we're going to get into a couple of tracks from late 90s films. The first one is going to be from the Dust Brothers from the film Fight Club. Now, when they were making Fight Club, the director petitioned a few different bands. He tried to get Radiohead on board for the soundtrack. He talked about two different groups about ideas, but he needed something groundbreaking. Everything in Fight Club was sort of unique. If you think about the opening scene of Fight Club, where it's like this camera flying through this weird computer-generated world where the camera dives into a trash can and comes out looking at a Starbucks cup, and it's just weird. You forget about it, but if you go back and look at it, the first 4 minutes of Fight Club, they said, took longer to film than like an hour of the movie because of the the complications of, I guess, doing that kind of computer generation. And they needed an artist who could match the innovative style of the film. So they landed on, of course, the Dust Brothers, known best probably for the production on the Beastie Boys album Paul's Boutique or the Beck album Odelay. They have an interesting style where they will, say a 4-minute song is happening, they will change significantly the style of the song like every 45 seconds. So when you listen to one track, you feel like you're listening to a little mini rock opera or a little symphony. It takes you all over the place. And just the style of it, to me, it made the movie. Fight Club, I loved that movie as much as I did, mostly because of the soundtrack and the way it went up against the characters and the way it just wove itself into the story. And it just wouldn't have been the same if you had put a bunch of top 40 hits from the 70s or something like that. Though they did end up using the Pixies, Where Is My Mind, for that final shot, which was really killer. So here we go with, let's see, the name of this track is Homework, and all these track names sort of match up with different scenes in the movies, but this is from the Dust Brothers. This is Homework. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Austin Community College with an 11th campus now open in Leander. Registration for fall classes and programs is going on now at austincc.edu. ACC, start here, get there.
Underwriting with co-ops is a lot about you and your business. As a co-op underwriter, you join a community of people who are passionate about public radio. When you invest in co-op, you are investing in a station that informs, educates, and entertains. Find out more about becoming an underwriter and supporting community radio by calling 512-472-1369 or go online to koop.org.
Who was that British lady? I don't know if I recognize that voice. Is that someone?
Around? Yeah, it's one of ours. I can't remember her name either.
Okay. I thought we borrowed a BBC reporter for that.
She's one of ours.
So just before those magical underwritings, again, you're listening to this streaming live on KOOP.org. KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby right here in the heart of Austin, Texas. Tonight's theme is soundtracks, if you're just tuning in. And for those of you who are tuning in any capacity, I really appreciate it. We love you listening to us as we prattle on and regale you with stories from soundtracks over the years, mostly focusing on tonight between the 1960s and the early 2000s. We don't really break out of that too much. I wanted to make this, you know, a couple of upbeat numbers. I didn't want to just bombard you with classical scores, which is, in the history of Hollywood, mostly what you're going to get is big classical scores, big musical numbers. Though, now that I think about it, I really should have done a track off Dancer in the Dark. Do you remember that film?
No.
Lars von Trier is the movie made with Björk. And it was done in Dogma style, which means no makeup, no artificial light, except there was these group of directors in the 90s who came up with this format called Dogma, and they imposed, like, several directors self-imposed this on themselves. No music outside, like, if you wanted music, there had to be a band playing live in the shot or whatever. No artificial light, you had to work with whatever light you had available. No makeup. And they just made these incredibly gritty films. It was Lars von Trier, Harmony Korine, the guy that did, like, Gummo and Kids, and several directors across the world sort of signed on to this. And with Dancer in the Dark, Lars von Trier finally broke out of Dogma by doing a film that was done with all the Dogma rules except for the musical numbers. So it would go from this harsh room temperature lighting, this, you know, it's a terribly sad film, and then all of a sudden it would burst into a musical number where all the Dogma rules disappeared. Suddenly there's lights, there's lush music, there's dancing, there's props, there's sight gags. It was very interesting. I highly recommend that if you've got an evening free to catch that film. So we heard before the break and before the previous track, we heard Dust Brothers from the Fight Club soundtrack, Homework. I won't gush on and on about the Dust Brothers, except I think they're geniuses. They're probably the greatest producers of all time, for my taste. After that, we heard from the Virgin Suicides soundtrack. We heard the band Air with their song Playground Love. Now, that was an interesting soundtrack. It was, first of all, the film was Sofia Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola's daughter's first directorial, you know, it was her debut. Coming onto the scene, and it was a good film, but there was something special about the soundtrack. I remember at the time living in Austin, you know, in my early 20s, maybe 22 or 23, and I had so many friends that had this soundtrack on CD, and I would get into someone's car, we were going out for the night, and they're playing this, and I'm like, oh, wow, you got this? What'd you think of the film? And people saying back to me, like, oh, there's a movie? It was one of those soundtracks that transcended and was so popular. It was as big as if it was like a new Radiohead album or something. And this band, Air, it wasn't as if they were huge. They weren't big at all. They had released an EP and a full-length album before this soundtrack, but they weren't big. You pretty much had to be kind of a hardcore audiophile to even know who in the world they were. And all of a sudden, they get commissioned to make this soundtrack, and it just blows up. Air becomes a band that can play clubs to a band that can play theaters pretty much overnight because of the success of the soundtrack. Mostly instrumental stuff, but there's a couple of bits with lyrics. I played the one track that was sort of the single off the soundtrack, which was High School... I forget the name of it. It's like High School Lover or something like that, but it's the one that had... Playground Love. And it's got that smooth vocal with that foreign accent that's so fun to listen to. And it's an incredible mix of keyboards and live saxophone and a little bit of strings in there. Just enough to keep your attention and put you into this lush floating space, kind of similar to Pink Floyd. So the group that recorded it, the main composer, Jean-Benoît Dunkel, if I'm saying that right, which I'm sure I'm not, he said it was recorded quickly. At first, the music was inspired by the movie. They would sort of project the movie on a screen, and the band would try to come up with stuff to synchronize. But he said towards the end of it, the process, all the intentions fell apart, and they just started crafting songs that they thought would be good enough for an album. And that was the big change. The big sea change for the record was that most musicians, when they take work making a soundtrack, they won't give you their best songs. Those are for their albums. So it's usually the first thing you come up with. I've done scores before for small productions, and really it's the first thing you think of off the top of your head. You look at the video and you just sort of play a little something. But when someone gives you their best tracks, that's when a soundtrack will go over the edge into something that transcends the film or can be just as important as the film. So the next thing we're going to get into is the soundtrack master, Ennio Morricone. He did the musical scores for the Sergio Leone spaghetti Western films, of which there were many. Just think of, you know, A Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, Once Upon a Time in the West. Ennio Morricone was the guy, and he also did the guitar work for Twin Peaks, if you ever saw that TV show. Think of that guitar, that down, down. That's Ennio. Ennio is considered to be one of the best working class composers, in that he would wake up at 6 a.m., start working on music at 7, and work all the way till 5. He treated music, scoring for films, like anyone would treat their 9-to-5 gig. He put in that many hours, and that's why he's so prolific. You know, you can get a 3-CD best of his stuff that doesn't even cover his whole career. The guy was just churning things out. And those spaghetti westerns, you have to think they didn't have a lot of money to make those films. You know, you're going to Italy making a western that's very dark and kind of startling, so they couldn't get the full orchestras, which is what most people would have wanted for that. So he gets this guy, Ennio, who just makes these simple things, an acoustic guitar with someone whistling behind it, or just it's just set this wonderful creepy tone for those classic spaghetti western films. So the one we're going to play tonight is one of his lesser known films or film scores, is from a movie called Death Rides a Horse. And this track is called Guitar Nocturne, and we're going to get into that right about now. Thank you. All right. From the Escape from New York soundtrack, that was John Carpenter himself, one of the few directors that does his own music for his own films. The old guy now, actually, I don't know if he's retired from making films, but he actually put together a group of young musicians to tour the country and play songs from his soundtracks over the years. And of course, he's in on the keyboards, and then he, you know, put a group of hipster guys together to be his backing band. And I saw some of the videos on YouTube of the shows, and they look like a blast. They put a movie screen behind them to show you clips from the movies to kind of take you back there. That was one of his most well-known films, of course, Escape from New York. And the track we heard was 69th Street Bridge. And we're just about to wrap up our soundtrack episode. I couldn't be more stoked about this one. It didn't have quite as much to say as I did on last week's murder music episode, but just the compiling together a set list of soundtrack songs was tremendous fun for me. We got a show coming up after this. You remember the name of that show?
Diamonds and Iron,
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's Show Tunes, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, right.
Actually, no. We got brutal.
Lounge music.
Yeah. We've got brutal, heavy, and gorgeous music coming up next. Last week, Blacksmith and I both did a murder show. It was a lot of fun. I love doing double headers like that. So last track we're going to get into is from from Elliot Smith. The unfortunately departed Elliot Smith. It's a song called Miss Misery from the Good Will Hunting soundtrack. This song won Elliot Smith a Grammy. Strangely enough, one of the few times an indie artist won a Grammy. So here we go with Miss Misery.
I'll fake it through the day with some help from Johnny Walker Red. Send the poison and rain down the drain to put bad thoughts in my head. Two tickets torn in half and a lot and nothing to do. Do you miss me? Miss misery like you said. Men in the park read the lines in my head, told me I'm strong, hardly ever wrong. I said, man, you mean you had plans for both of us that involved a trip out of town to a place I see in a magazine that you left lying around. I don't have you with me, but I keep a good attitude. Do you miss me? Miss misery like you say. See me gone, then see me.